So we'll continue with our discussion of the essence of the Fukan Zazengi in the essence of Zen by Harada Seke Roshi, his commentary on the Fukan Zazengi. Any questions about what we've studied so far or any questions about practice in general?
I did have one.
Okay.
All right, I wrote it down. If a personality is shaped by experiences and or circumstances, how can it be said that the true self exists beyond circumstance?
Pardon me?
I said, if a personality is shaped by experiences and or circumstances, how can it be said that the true self exists beyond circumstance?
It doesn't. It says the true self exists because of circumstances, because of the law of cause and effect, which is essentially circumstances. Circumstances are events that you make a decision about or becomes part of your way of seeing something or thinking about something. That's exactly like when I talk about there's no local reality. That's the same thing as circumstances. Circumstances mean what's happening at that moment, which can change at any moment. Circumstances are what is happening in this particular moment of reality. And that's what does shape us. Now, how we approach that particular moment of reality, the circumstances we're encountering, is what makes us who we are as time goes on. That's why being aware of the laws and being aware of the law of cause and effect means that we're very aware of the whole situation in circumstances. We can see all the different possibilities, or what would happen if we did this, or what would if we didn't do that. There's no true self outside of that. Everything is a relationship, a circumstance. The only thing is we tend to think, we react to a certain circumstance, and then what we do, and this is the problem, the cause of suffering, is that we form a kind of a way of dealing with that circumstance, and then when we encounter something that looks like that circumstance again, and it isn't, because nothing is the same in every single second there's something new. But our mind remembers it, and it seems like a similar circumstance, and we tend to relate to that circumstance in the memory of how we dealt with it, with what we thought was something similar to that. Then we create karma from that. But in actuality, our practice is to actually be the circumstances. But we don't do that. We carry a memory of things we've done, and because we want to have some sort of a blueprint of the next moment, how to react. And so when we encounter a similar situation or circumstances, we tend to go back to the memory of how we dealt with something similar before and try and do that, as opposed to realizing or being totally open to be one with that circumstance so that it can tell us what to do. We go like by old memories. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I'm just trying to remember how I came to ask it, because I could have swore that's what it said, that the true self exists beyond circumstances. Didn't I ask you when we read that? I mentioned that I was struck by that statement.
Well, there's in Buddhism, there is a paradox. There's always it seems to contradict itself a lot. But circumstances means Yes, I think we did. But in this particular context, circumstances means exactly what I just said when I said we tend to address a new moment with memories of an old moment. And that's, in that particular case, the actual, that's where the true self is outside circumstances. Because the true self always reacts to what the reality is of that moment. But our mind doesn't work that way. It's always trying to get a handle on everything so it remembers something similar or somewhat close to that circumstance. And then it tries to address that issue with that memory, that sort of already made up way of addressing that circumstance, because it's a memory. So it's like, oh, and it's how would I put that? It wants to be able to. It's the mind is terrified of addressing a real moment, because in a real moment, which is that's where the original, that's where the true self truly is, in a sense. It's always in the real moment, but we don't, we're afraid to do that, because in a real moment, there's no map there. You have to, instead of you laying out your map because you remember that situation before, it's similar to something, and you feel like you have a handle on the situation, and you're going to address that situation according to that memory, that's when you're caught by circumstances. But the enlightened being literally can't do that. They've dropped off body and mind. There's no ability to form this conceptual framework, this kind of map of reality before you get to that next moment. Or when you even address a similar moment, it's the same thing, throwing out a kind of a map on that. And then when we try and react to that moment, we create karma. But the true self literally is outside of circumstances in the fact that it doesn't create the map. But at the same time, circumstances do create us. The truth of the moment, things as they are, create us. Because it's how we respond to them. So in a sense, you could call that circumstances. I think this is the sound of it, and my memory of it is circumstances here has a very fabricated, it has a very conceptual feel to it. But the true self is really outside of circumstances in terms of they literally address the moment as it is. So that's the big difference. I think in terms of what you're saying, circumstances, and I know that has a different connotation, and we did address that somewhere in here, but I think, like I said, has circumstances here in terms of some kind of framework, some sort of prefabricated way of entering a moment. And the true self is free of that. The true self doesn't, it literally allows the moment to tell them what to do. Being caught by circumstances means you allow the circumstances to, well, you, no, you are in the middle of that circumstance, and then through your opinion and your memories, you react to that circumstance through this conceptual framework that you've laid on top of that moment. The self is, the ego self is terrified of approaching a moment with no idea whatsoever about what to do or what anything is, or so as a consequence, very quickly, it's just laying out a whole framework. And then in that particular moment, it can be caught by circumstances because it creates its own problem. It does the same thing over and over again because it's reacting to its own fabrication of what it thinks that moment is. That's why a lot of times people say, well, people don't change. People, they don't change. People or that person can't change. Because what they're doing is they're acting over and over again in the same way as you've described it with your father. The same thing. And a lot of people do that because it's secure for them. They literally, it's a habit. It's so ingrained in their being that when they approach something, it's like it kicks in and that's how they're going to react. They don't stop and take a big, deep breath, zazen, or being in the moment and say, wait a minute, just realize what they're doing. And then in creating that space, they begin to sense that maybe this is not the same situation. Maybe they're not getting it right. Or maybe they're taking a deeper look at what's happening. But it's a real, almost habitual being caught by circumstances is when you literally cannot get out of your own construct. So you don't know how to address a situation. Over and over again. People do it all the time. Ideas about people, opinions about this, whatever it is, that they just throw that out there. And then that, in doing that, they create karma because they're not addressing the situation as it is. So being outside of circumstances just means that being, the enlightened being, it can't be caught because they don't have anything fabricated at all. They're open. That situation speaks to them. They're literally totally open. And because they're open, it feels like the situation is all of a sudden right in your face. Feels like it's just telling you what to do. Well, that's true. It is. And that's a being who's not caught by circumstance. That's why I talk so many times about that particular time I had with Hirata Seki Roshi, asking him about, well, it's the actual confirmation of a true teacher. Is someone who isn't caught by circumstances. But I'm asking him about Dharma transmission. Now, if he were caught by circumstance, he would have, in a kind of a very subtle way, but still caught by circumstance, said, well, I'll just shore. I'll just make tea and shore. I won't say anything. But, I mean, you don't think it through like that. It's much more organic. But that would have been caught by circumstance. I would have felt that. I would have felt like he's trying to show me something. I didn't feel that at all. It's like he just pivoted, and that's why my initial impression of him was, oh, he didn't understand what I said, because I don't have a translator here. He understood what I said. He knows the words Dharma transmit. He knows what I was asking him. Nothing moved. He wasn't caught by anything. He wasn't going to create something or not create. He didn't need to. He was already the thing itself. So he just pivoted and nothing moved and started making tea. That's being totally not caught by circumstance. The people are caught by circumstance all the time. It's amazing if you'll see this in your zazen, how an opinion arises in your mind about everything. Oh, you see a particular person and you think, oh, that person is this, this, and this. And then if you're truly doing the practice and following the Eightfold Noble Path and the precepts, your mind will go, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing here? I don't really know this person. I mean, I can just see what my mind is doing. It's creating this thought formation thing. I'm going from thought A1 to thought A10, and I've developed a whole story about this person. I have no idea. How many times have you been wrong about judging a situation and it never turned out that way? That's being caught by circumstance. But the other side of that is that through relationship, that's who we become. It's relationship, or if you call it circumstances, but to me, circumstances in relationship, the situation of that moment, circumstances, will, it depends on that statement we read in here, whether there's the ego self intervenes or not. If the ego self intervenes, then you're caught by circumstance. There it goes again, creating a story and having an opinion or whatever it is, and therefore not really addressing the issue versus not the ego self not intervening. And in that particular case, all of a sudden, there's this immediate, the circumstances are telling us what to do. And that doesn't mean you resign yourself to the circumstances. It means you are totally aware of the circumstances. And because of that awareness, you know what to do. So, any further question about that?
I half expected you to say that the true self is free to become those circumstances. Like,
free to become those circumstances.
Because you're not encumbered by the stories that you told, or the stories of what happened, you know, in previous instances that are similar to the situation that you find yourself in.
Yeah, well, you've got to be careful what you mean by to become. What you do is the circumstances speak to you. Be careful about becoming the circumstances. It simply allows you to see the circumstances as they are, the situation as it is.
Okay.
And in that seeing, you've got to realize it isn't the seeing that that most people do, which is perceiving something. This is a kind of seeing whereby there's no perception. And the way you know how to interact with that is because you are one with it, you feel it. But
that's what I meant. Yeah.
Well, but be very careful. Okay, good. If that's truly what you meant. But the words aren't quite right. Because they're, when you experience what's called identity action, which you're describing and we're talking about, you see, for instance, you see a rock. And in terms of no intervention of the ego self, there's... it's so profound that you don't know if the rock or the rock is you. And because there's no conceptual, no verbal dialogue, no judging, no nothing is going on. So, but as a consequence, all of a sudden you understand thoroughly the rock. You can feel its weight, its texture. You can even feel the age of the rock. That is what you're describing, but you don't walk away thinking you're the rock. So you can't say, I've become, in a way, you are one with the rock. But that doesn't mean they're two things. It just means at that moment, it's not two. There are no two things there. But you don't walk away thinking you're a rock either. But in that moment, you literally do not know if the rock is you or you are the rock. Because there's no way to label it. So there's no sense of it's out there and it's a rock. But at the same time, you know it now, you really know what a rock is. Because you can feel its entire life of the rock. It's an amazing thing. And then you walk away and that was, now you know exactly, now you know what a rock is. But it doesn't, but you don't, you have to be careful with becoming the thing itself. You do become the thing itself, but again, all of this we're talking in terms of words, conceptual framework. So becoming one with the thing itself is this thing called identity action, whereby you don't know if you're it or it is you. It's not, that's not two. And we tend to think of, when we say becoming the thing itself, that somehow there was a self and it evaporated and it's become one or something. There is no self. So identity action is simply the internal dialogue, the labeling process, the conceptual framework is not functioning. That's the grasping part. We need to study the 12-fold chain of causation. Is no longer, it can't. It has realized that there are no two things. So the habit of creating a sense of substantiality, therefore, if it must be, it's indifferent. It does one, the human mind does something extra, like I said before, that the universe doesn't. And that's, the universe says, oh, there's tons of difference out there. But the universe doesn't say difference means they're separate. Now, conceptual, for the conceptual or the ego self, same thing, can't even fathom that. For it, the only reality is if it's different, it has to be not me, separate. And that's the creation of this and something else. But the universe says, no, you can have difference all over the place and they're not, it's not separate. Conceptual can't, it can't go there because it's concept. Its reality is forming boundaries, forming distinctions. So we simply don't play with that part that comes up that always in our mind until one day we realize, and that's when there's no intervention of the ego self, we realize, oh, that's what not two is. That's what ident, well, that's what a rock is. So it's, but I think you're close. I mean, yes, I think that's a good question. You asked an excellent question. Very good question. And the trick is to really totally resolve the great matter of life and death. So, but that's correct. The thinking of outside of circumstances. And the realization of that comes from an empirical knowing of what that is, not some sort of, we can discuss it, and it's important to discuss it because it keeps us directed in the sort of tuned into the right way of looking at reality. But the actual understanding of what that really means is an empirical thing, which is what we do with our zazen. Which is, the mind is not creating two things. There's no intervention of the ego self. It's not labeling things or having a framework of something. It's just seeing something. It's just hearing something. And as a consequence, because it doesn't do that, it's realized there's no two things. But that realization of no two things is totally empirical. I mean, it's the most difficult thing a human being can do because we've been doing it for many, many, many years under all circumstances. So for us to let go of that last remnant that thinks it's got it, I've got this. You know, when we chant, during the session in the evening service, we chant the ten verses of unfathomable depths. And in that, there's this discussion about that particular thing that we're talking about right now, and this no creation of two things. So, and how difficult that particular thing is. It's the most difficult thing a human being can do. And it's the wording in that about, especially that last verse, standing before the absolute. It says like a crane standing in the snow, and this is what we're talking about, is not the same color. A crane, and they're talking about a white crane standing in snow, they're not the same color. Well, the mind goes, what? There is a white crane and there's white snow. This again, this is trying to see how much you try and see the universe in terms of getting a handle on it. Like, I want to understand, what do you mean? The crane is white, the snow is white, what are you talking about here? Then the last thing it says is your practice is, or the realization is playing a harp, playing the harp with no strings. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about being beyond circumstance. Circumstance is just when you want to get it, you want to have it, you want to have some thing you can get a hold of there. It's just something that you can just grab, get a hold of. That's what the mind is always doing. That's the thing that drops off in the enlightenment experience. That's why we say dropping off body and mind. There's nothing there. There's no self. So playing the harp on those strings, the mind goes, you can't play. I mean, even as your practice deepens, and that's your koan, which would be a great koan, you're always thinking, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be really understanding, playing the harp on those strings. And it sounds so, it is beautiful. It's beautiful because it's true. But, and then your mind keeps trying to understand it. It feels neat and wow, I'm trying to understand it, trying to understand it, until one day it realizes it can't understand playing a harp with no strings. Concept only works in the realm of, you can't play a harp without strings. Because we think we can answer it by saying you can't play a harp with no strings. That's still caught with conceptual framework. You have to come to that place whereby all of a sudden you understand what playing a harp with no strings means empirically. All of a sudden you'll just go, oh, now I understand it. Because you realize how much your mind wants to have this thing, this grab it, have a construct. All of a sudden, no. Just the stopping of that is what our practice is. That's what shikantaza is. That's what the koan practice is. That's what not being caught by circumstances is. That's what no intervention of the ego self is. That's our whole practice. But it's so difficult to let go of that last little part that even when you get into deeper aspects, so to speak, of your practice, and you'll experience incredible things, there's always kind of a sense that you've got something. Or there could be a sense of, I've got something. It's much more refined and much more subtle. But I've talked to a lot of teachers, and they don't say it. And they know they're not supposed to even think that. But there's a part of them that feels like, I've got it. I've got it. I understand it. I've got it. But no. That's why it's so difficult even to let go of that last little bit of the conceptual framework that wants to just hold on to it a little bit. No, we take the step off the top of the 100-foot pole. So the only thing a true teacher realizes is the moment that the student or anyone does that grabbing process when they try it with the creation of two things. I see it immediately.
Am I understanding correctly that you might be able to tell if you're caught in that way? Because when you have that feeling or that thought that you've got something, that thought or feeling is dependent on an experience that you had. So you would have to turn to a memory of something that you experienced in order to feel.
That's in the as you practice is in the beginning, so to speak. As you get deeper and deeper in practice, there isn't like that. It is more like the actual process of going, It's like you can feel the moment it goes, That's what you feel. It's so basic. It's very, very basic. All of a sudden you can feel you can just feel the moment that starts to be created. There's no memory. It's actually recognizing the moment you make the movement. That's why we sit and we sit and we sit. First we notice, boy, our mind is going a mile a minute, and so we sit and we sit, and that calms down, and then we become more and more aware of the moment we start to do that, and then we have, anyway, as a, we have deeper experiences of the truth, and that's what the Buddha did with when he studied with the three great teachers and the four jhanas. He was actually perfecting it, and a different depths of settling into not to, and getting to places whereby, as you become more in union with everything, you also experience enormous compassion, tremendous compassion, just love for everything, and you don't want to harm anything, because the mind is realizing this unity with everything, so it's like it can't harm anything. And then you get stuck there because it's kind of sticky. That's in the third jhana, which is pitti. And the Buddhists realized it was still sticky. It was still being caught. And so even in the fourth jhana, and so he literally couldn't find a teacher who could go beyond that, so he did. And that's that last little remnant of giving up any kind of thing that you can feel at that moment is sticky, or you're getting caught by something. It doesn't make any difference if it's the greatest realization you've ever had, if it's the worst thing, whatever it is that comes up in practice. Just you realize the moment, oh, it's wonderful, I feel great, and okay, thank you, no. I go back to the breath. It's really not being caught by anything. It's an interesting thing. It's like, for instance, I like college football. And my brother this weekend, Indiana was going to play, or Indiana played UCLA. Well, I knew Indiana was probably going to really literally obliterate UCLA. They're number two in the country. And so, but then I'm still a UCLA fan, and there was hope. I had hopes that, you know, UCLA might beat Indiana. But inside, I realized, wow, Indiana is their whole team. They've never been this good in 50 years, very long time. Indiana was always considered the worst, you know, they're just, and I don't know if they're part of the Big Ten. I don't follow that part. I just follow the games, and some of the games. So, but and now for the first time in their school history, they're number two in the country, and a lot of hard work, and my brother lives in Indiana, and I'm here in UCLA, and I'm thinking, oh, poor UCLA is only one three games, they've lost four games, and I like UCLA. But in watching the game, I couldn't figure out who I wanted to win. Because Indiana, they worked hard. They literally, football is a really, any sport, when there's, and politics and religion all have real sticky points to them. So, and I just thought, wow, I don't know who I want to win. I mean, Indiana's worked hard, and I would really, and my brother lives there, and I felt like Indiana is a university, and maybe the people in Indiana had, this was the first time in years and years and years their team was doing so well. And then I looked at UCLA, and I said, yeah, but UCLA, the poor things have been, you know, they lost their first four games, and now they've won three, and they, you know. And then the point I'm trying to make is that you literally can enjoy the whole process of something without being stuck in a particular place, which is, oh, but UCLA is my team and I hope they beat Indiana. I mean, I had a remnant of that. But I really just thought, wow, I don't really care whichever team wins here. I just a good football game and just see how it goes. It was 56-6, by the way. Poor UCLA. They got, oh, Indiana's a very good team. And so, but my point of this whole thing is that's no different than the Buddha realizing in that third jhana, that pity, that feeling of, geez, I really want UCLA to win, and it's wonderful they're winning or whatever. That came up, and he realized, oh, I'm still stuck here. I need to let that go, no matter what the feeling is. And so, as a consequence, he, mastered the four jhanas, and then the teacher said, we can't teach you anything anymore. He hadn't resolved the great matter because he could feel within himself he was still getting caught. So he went and sat for 3 weeks. And the last week, he didn't get up until he resolved the great matter. And that's that same immovability of that I saw him in Ruwata Sekki Roshi. He literally didn't have some sort of agenda that he was going to teach me something because he just was not to. He just responded in a normal way for that enlightened being would respond, which is, well, I'll just make some tea here. And that non-movement within him is what the Buddha realized on the morning of the eighth day of his sitting, is that the minute it's the totally becoming one with that moment, with the universe. And you just do it once. It just has to happen once. And because it's so pure, so true, it confirms itself. No one needs to tell you, you just realize the truth. And there's also no feeling within yourself that you've got something. You just feel like, oh yeah, I forgot all about this. That's right, I forgot this. It's always been this way. So there's no turning around, which would be the conceptual, the intervening of the ego self, to say, I've got something. You're too full. I mean, there's no two things anymore. You can't turn around and look at yourself. It's impossible. So that's essentially what not being, that is what not being caught by circumstances is. And then you can, we could, it would be so wonderful if the Republicans and Democrats could sit down and have a kind of a, that kind of, even a semblance of that kind of wisdom or way of doing their life so they could literally be able to listen, both sides listen to each other and actually see the good points in each person's side. There's good points and bad points in both. So that's what our practice is. Our practice is to be able to become this thing. Realize this thing, meaning realize you're Buddha and you've always been Buddha. And that there is no self. And then you can enjoy watching the football game. And then, or you can work things out in politics. Or you can realize the moment that you're starting to create a problem with some sort of interaction you're having, you can feel it. You'll feel it right away. You'll just stop. Oh, nope. Because you'll feel what you're doing. It's not a thought. It's not, it's deeper than that. It's the moment you feel that, you'll just feel it, what you do. It's a thing that the mind does, it's called grasping. And you'll feel the moment it starts to kind of do that. It won't be able to do it anyway. In dropping off body and mind, it can never do that. I would say it can't ever do that again. It still has a little memories of trying to do it, but then it just can't do it. It can't do it. It can't do it. Because it's one. So our practice is to sit, and it's an empirical practice. It isn't just believing in something and studying stuff, although we do, it's very important to study. Our practice is, and this is the true intent of every true practice, every true religion, although most people don't want to invest that much energy into really becoming the Ten Commandments or becoming seeing their neighbor as themselves. They like to remind themselves and they try and live by it, but to actually become that, I think most people, they'd like to, but they just don't want to put all that effort into it. It's a lot of effort, and it is a lot of effort. But being as that is who you are, and you have the pivotal opportunity of human form, which is the Fukan Zazengi, do not use your time in vain. You're going to die anyway, and in death, that's the great teacher. You really realize there's no two things. You can actually, when people are dying, there's a part of them that they can feel how would you say it? Connection's not a good enough word. Not even attachment, but they feel the dissolution of their attachment to their body. They can feel something's happening. They can feel it. That's why death is very real. They all of a sudden, and they know. Because that sense of being in this substantiality, this attachment to the idea of a substantial self is gone. So the letting go of body and mind is, in our practice, is called resolving the great matter of life and death. That is what it is. That's how deep our habit is of creating two things, almost to the point of death. It's just, that's why we sit and we sit and we sit and we sit. And we practice the Eightfold Noble Path, the precepts, we make a deep commitment to just resolving the great matter of life and death. To realize this pivotal opportunity of human form. It's a pivotal opportunity. I mean, how many, like I said, there's 100 million stars and who knows how many trillions of planets in this galaxy. And I really feel, looking at all the things I know, that we may be the only intelligent, I'm not talking about life, but intelligent life, that's able to realize what it is, what the universe is. So that's this pivotal opportunity of human form. Just do not use your time in vain. So where did we leave off in here?
March 16.
Okay, very good. On page 16, second paragraph. I sometimes speak of Zazen of the body, speech, and thought. Zazen of the body is the form of Zazen we are presently sitting in. It is the condition of Zazen Samadhi. Samadhi means being one with everything. Practice Samadhi to the extent that there isn't the least margin for thought to enter. Zazen of speech is the sutra chanting we did this morning, just chanting the Heart Sutra and the four Bodhisattva vows is enough. Zazen of thought includes miscellaneous ideas and various other thoughts, such as making plans. Zazen of the body, speech, and thought all take place separately from the consciousness of the ego self. The Dharma vehicle functions actively in this way. So this is what we've been talking about. Zazen of the body, speech, and thought all take place separately from the consciousness of the ego self. The Dharma vehicle functions actively in this way. So this is what we talk about when we talk about identity action or empirical practice. That an action is performed before your thought process. Afterwards, your thought process goes, wow, why did I do that? Or the person saves someone from a burning car And you ask them afterwards, how in the world did you do that? And they'll say, I don't even know how I did it. That's when they were separate. All this body, speech, and thought are take separately from the consciousness of the ego self. Indeed, the whole body of reality is far beyond the world's dust. All the phenomena of the world that we perceive and observe are the Dharma and the way itself. Everything is the Dharma. This is the whole body of reality. Naturally, this means that there isn't the slightest possibility that dirt and dust, such as deluding passions or enlightenment, delusion or realization can enter. Interesting, he doesn't say deluding passions. He says deluding passions or enlightenment. That's what the Buddha realized in doing the jhanas. He had to let go of everything, even the deepest realizations, the deepest feelings and what he was experiencing at that moment. He had to let go of everything. The mind forms an opinion about everything. So who can believe in a means to brush it clean? And again, this is in reference to that particular challenge, the fifth ancestor in China asked his students to write what they knew about the Dharma, kind of like the talks people are going to give here, on the temple wall so he could see where their understanding was. And one of them wrote that the mind is like a mirror, you have to keep brushing it clean to keep the dust off of it. And then Hui Neng, who was a brand new monk, wrote, there's no mirror, there's no dust. And the teacher realized, oh, this is the person I'll transmit to. He understands the Dharma. So that's what this is in reference to. So it says, all phenomena in the world that we perceive and observe are the Dharma and the way itself. Period. It's Buddhism more than any other, well, some contemplative aspects of other religions can do this, but says that there's no spiritual and mundane. So Bodhidharma's comment about what is the Dharma, vastness, and nothing holy. Nothing holy means everything. It means all phenomena of the world that we perceive and observe are the Dharma and the way itself. Nothing holy. Everything is, or everything's holy. This is the whole body of reality. Naturally, this means there isn't the slightest possibility that dirt and dust, how can it be if everything is the Dharma, such as deluding passions or enlightenment, delusion or realization can enter. Who can believe in a means to brush it clean? As there is no dust or dirt, there's no deluding passions versus enlightenment. There's no need for any cleaning. At this point, I would like to relate an anecdote concerning Daimon Konin. Oh, he's going to talk about it, what we just talked about. The fifth ancestor in China after Bodhidharma. But right there, any questions about this?
No.
This is.
I thought you were asking.
I was asking.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't have any question about it.
Okay. As there is no dust or dirt, then there is no need for any cleaning. At this point, I would like to talk about this particular thing that we just talked about. In order to determine his successor, Daimon Konin arranged to give a test to the monks on the true self. Initially, a monk named Jinshu gave the following answer. Our condition is like a mirror. We must always clean the mirror, otherwise it will naturally become cloudy. Constantly make an effort to keep it clean, never let it become dusty. Oh, I can't think of anything that's more than indicative of two things than that. It's saying you shouldn't be this, you should be that. In response to this, Daiken Enno, another monk practicing with Daimon Konin, wrote, essentially, there's nothing. Where can dust or dirt collect? Essentially, there's nothing means that fundamentally, all things arise because of the law of causation. and consequently have no substance. That's what I was trying to say in the beginning when we talked about circumstance. Essentially, all things arise because of the law of causation. Circumstances or causation, I was thinking more in terms of causation, and consequently have no substance. As there is no substance, dust and dirt, in other words, the deluding passions and enlightenment, cannot collect anywhere. This is how he answered the test question. I think it is clear to all of you which one passed the test. Of course, it was Daikon Eno, known as Hui Neng in Chinese. However, if we have not heard of the Buddhist teaching and were to think of practice in the usually accepted sense, it would be easier for us to accept the answer of Jinshu. Constantly make an effort to keep the mirror clean, never let it become dirty, dusty. This seems to be the correct way to practice, but it is clearly mistaken. These two viewpoints are as far apart as heaven and earth. And this is what we talk about all the time. The minute you create any sense of other, that essentially that movement, grasping, is what I was talking about. Any sense that movement, it's the actual, the moment your mind tries to form something about what it's encountering, it wants to get a hold on it, just get a handle on it. That's that first monk thinking, well, you know, with that kind of thinking, there's always this idea that whatever your situation is, it's never, you never accept your present situation fully. Because it's also the four noble truths. The first noble truth, all life is suffering. The cause of it is that at this particular moment, you are suffering because totally and completely, you are not okay with this moment. Even if you think you're at peace and you're zot, well, that's probably the closest. When the mind isn't moving, it doesn't make a movement. The movement is, that creates the idea that there's something else. That's what it does. There's something else. And if there's something else, that you cannot realize what perfect peace is. Perfect peace is when there literally is no, the realization that there's no other. There's nowhere to go to or get or lose or anything. It's all there. And it's an incredible realization. But we never accept, we always think this, it's the dust and dirt thing. I'm sitting, even though I'm told we sit to realize we are Buddha, not to become Buddha, but to realize we've always been Buddha. There's a part of us that looks at how we are as a being and says, well, yeah, but I don't seem to be like a Buddha. I mean, I don't feel like I'm a Buddha. I mean, I see all the things that I do. And all those things that you do are your wonderful, very quick labeling of all the different things you've done. So when you say everything is the Dharma, it takes away other. Buddhism doesn't, I think, especially, I'm most familiar with Christianity, is very polar in a way, very dual. Spiritual and mundane, heaven and earth, evil and good. Buddhism doesn't do it that way. And Buddhism doesn't say people do things because they're evil. Buddhism says people do bad things because they are ignorant of the law of cause and effect. They literally,
because of circumstance, right?
Yes. They do things not because of, how would you say that? Well, it depends on which side you're on, but yes, when you can't see the situation clearly, when you aren't putting your, if you're putting your label on that, that's the creation of circumstances. I see circumstances as in terms of, I think we're seeing it in different ways. That's why you have to be careful with language, words. Circumstances to me can mean, I took it to mean conditions. Being free of, and actually, that's, I think, a better word than circumstances, but I see that we can use those two in a kind of a way. The Dharma is unconditioned. The Dharma is everything and is unconditioned. So what does that mean? Unconditioned means it is what it is. So, but it's our opinion, our judgment, our framework about that thing that creates the problem. And how does it do that? By doing Zazen, to study Buddhism is to study the self. And in studying that, what we're seeing is how we create a framework that's the cause, that second noble truth, the cause of suffering, that we've created our a reality on top of a reality, of real reality. It's our framework that we're doing. We're creating our framework about everything. So even though everything is the Dharma, we're busy judging parts of that as, oh, that's not really the Dharma, or this is the Dharma, or that person's good, or that person's whatever it is that we're doing constantly. The realization in dropping off body and mind is that there never was a time ever that you weren't enlightened. It doesn't say, oh, now I'm enlightened, and before I wasn't enlightened, or now I've got it and I can understand, and before I didn't understand. That is not realization. Realization is that you've always been enlightened, which means your entire being always been enlightened. It's what we do with this that creates suffering. That's why the Four Noble Truths are so profound. All life is suffering. First Noble Truth, Second Noble Truth. What is the cause of that? Desire, which desire simply means we aren't happy with this present moment. We don't, and to understand the depth to what that means is what our practice is. Because it means you have to know the moment that your mind makes the slightest little movement out of being totally present in the moment. The slightest little movement. That's the creation of intervention of the ego self. It's the first time, it's interesting that, and I am going to write him, that, oh, I've forgotten his name. He's an astrophysicist. He's also a very unusual man. He's in England and he's a very well-known astrophysicist. And he's interested in astrophysics, but he's also interested in consciousness. He's sort of an astrophysicist philosopher type person. And he thinks that consciousness is created from going from a superposition state in terms of astrophysics, which means everything is all present. A superpositioned situation is where it's neither one or the other, it's they're both there. There's no, and they're both there. It doesn't mean there's two of them there and they're both there. It means it's they're both identical. In the computer, classical computers are zero or one, and they function that way because it's made off of our conceptual framework. But the quantum computer is not that way. The quantum computer says, oh, I can be both at the same time, a zero and a one, both at the same time, identical. So he thinks consciousness is when that superposition, which means there is no self because there's no other, is broken. It collapses. And when it collapses, all of a sudden, the mind chooses either the zero or the one. And when it does that, it creates the intervention, it creates its sense of self. It's the one or it's the zero. And that's that. What the mind does with difference, it thinks difference means separate. Superposition doesn't say that. Superposition says, fine, I'm both a zero and a one. I have no problem with that. Well, that's what the enlightened state is. So they can look back and see, well, they don't see it like that. They just realize forever it's always been not two. Because they don't create a before and after. They don't create, oh, I remember when I was back then and I had that realization and now I'm this and this is, I'm now really enlightened. No. It's a realization of, oh, I've always been this way. It's always been like this, and it feels ancient. The ancient part is that it goes back. It feels like it's some memory you forgot 1,000 years ago. That's because that's the also the realization of time. There's no two things in terms of time either. Well, there's no two things. So we don't talk about space and time anymore. Even in physics, they talk about space-time, space-time. They're inseparable. Now, why they can't quite get to the understanding, especially when they can see entanglement, photon entanglement, that maybe that means everything is that way. They're slowly getting there. But the Buddha realized that. That's what he's why he said there's no self. There's no self. There's no other. The way we've evolved, I think, just that was our way of protecting ourselves is the human consciousness. We didn't have claws and enormous strength, but we did have this. But unfortunately, or fortunately, it has good and bad aspects. Right now, we're in the very bad aspect of our development as a species, but it could figure out the next situation. You could figure out something by judging. And in doing that, it created the illusion that things were separate. They're different, they're separate. Well, the universe doesn't do that. Quantum physics, which is the basis of all reality, tells us that all the time. The law of causality is described by those three physicists who literally proved there's no local reality, which people haven't quite, hasn't sunk in yet. They don't realize what it's bothering them a lot because it takes away their whole premise of the scientific method, which is based on fact, which is good. Actually, that's a fact in a way, but it's also based on having something concrete. Well, this is saying, I'm sorry, but there's no two things. There's no substantiality. Well, that's what the Buddha realized. So our practice in daily life is to function that. We function it by following the Eightfold Noble Path, which is constantly putting yourself in the form of not two and the precepts and zazen over and over again. Because it isn't something that you can really understand intellectually. You can understand it to a certain degree, but you'll never realize the truth. You'll have to become it. You can't have your cake and eat it too. Good question. You've got that's a really good question. I think Cedric will be back next week. I'm not sure. I think he said 1 or 2 weeks. So hopefully he'll be back at some point.
Good night.
Yes.